Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home.
There's no place like home to learn more about health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse.
In the old days, you spent a lot of time at the patient's bedside, and now the common saying is that you spend more time with the computer.
You know, people will want to wait in my waiting room for me because it's me.
He was like, forget it, because I can't pay it out of pocket.
Trees can't move as fast as climate changes.
200 degrees is a lot more tolerable
than
one would
think. Am I an alcoholic?
You know, when you think about it, a connected refrigerator is actually a horrible idea.
He's the first to say the emperor has no clothes.
It's our stay-at-home special edition of The Pulse today. We'll explore how science is making homes healthier. We'll check into exercising at home and find out why hobby astronomers don't even have to leave home at all to watch the stars. But first up, how is this for a prescription from your doctor? 10 days of no cognitive stimulation. No phone, no TV, no loud noises, nothing. That's what Theo Balcombe was prescribed after she suffered a severe concussion when she slipped while getting out of bed one random morning. Disoriented and exhausted from the aftermath of her fall, Theo's sister Hallie swooped in to help her on the journey back to health.
She kidnapped me. I did basically kidnap you. You really didn't want me to come. And I said, I'm coming.
And this began my time in the concussion cave.
You were very adamant about being in a dark space.
I did not want to be near light at all. I needed total darkness. Light was the enemy, and we had to fight it as best we could.
I shut the blinds, and I have a four-poster bed, so I put a blanket over the top of it. But you could sense the light coming through the cracks of the blinds. You were very unhappy about that. So I tried and put additional blankets over that area, creating complete darkness.
Oh, and it felt so good to be in the dark. And I just slept and slept and slept.
Things were worse than I thought they were. You were emotionally unstable. It was just very up and down. You were never at a moderate level.
Everything that wasn't sitting or sleeping was overwhelming.
The lack of control over your emotions. Even if something happy happened, you know, like you felt a sweet, nice moment, you would cry.
It was hard. You know, you can't interact with the world the way you used to. People look at you and you can't explain yourself. You're lost and you freeze up and it's awkward to make conversation because your mind isn't working the way you want it to. Your brain isn't working the way that it should, and you know that it can.
You were really worried your mind wasn't going to come back.
When I met with a neurologist for the first time, he said to me, the neurologist, point blank, said, "We know very little about the brain." Okay, that's a direct quote from my neurologist.
And I was always, although I was aware that this was a very serious concussion, I was always sure your mind was going to come back.
Everybody kept saying it's going to be fine, but when you're trapped inside your head like that and it's not working the way it should.
But I knew how stressed you were.
How do you know that you're going to get back to normal? You don't know.
A week after you had been at my house, we decided that it was time for you to go back and live in your apartment.
Okay, I can leave the concussion cave. These were my biggest fears at the time. Getting mugged, getting hit by a bus crossing the street.
Yeah, you're really worried about getting hit by a bus.
And having to go to work and sit under the neon lights. Because I didn't have my wits about me, I hadn't been in normal lighting, and something about those three things I just fixated on.
Which, you know, now we laugh about. And I think I probably laughed about it at the time, but you did not laugh about it. You were really sure something bad was going to happen to you because of the concussion.
Honestly, at the time, my doctors just wanted me to go at my own pace. They said I should do only what I felt comfortable with. And my neurologist said I should gradually increase my activity. But I wanted to push it. screw gradual. I wanted to get back to normal as soon as I could. I passed in this doctor's note to HR, and it said, she will attempt to gradually increase as tolerated. And I could tolerate work eventually. And it was probably because I shut down so much when I was in the concussion cave.
Because the integration back into real life is so gradual, it doesn't feel like there was a stop or a start. It was more just you. One day were you, and we didn't think about the concussion.
I'm back. I'm okay with the neon lights. They even put me in charge of the radio show for a while. And I get to listen and watch and hear and see all kinds of things. And I don't worry about my brain.
That's Theo Balcom. She is a producer at NPR's All Things Considered in Washington, D.C. And we also heard from her sister, Hallie. So what is the best course of action after a concussion? Science on this issue has been growing and changing at a quick pace in recent years. And joining us now to talk more is Sarah Allen. She's a pediatric neuropsychologist at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Of course.
Now, for some time, it seemed like absolute total rest after a concussion was the way to go. Then there was a new study that came out in pediatrics at the end of last year that seemed to say maybe rest is not always the way to go.
Absolutely. They've just really changed a lot of the recommendations for returning to anything after a concussion. It used to be 10 days or longer sometimes that you'd stay in a dark room and, you couldn't have access to any phones or any television or anything like that. And the longer your rest, they felt that would get you back to activity faster. Now they're just saying that's not the case. And what we're seeing clinically is that's not the case either. So now they're saying about 3 to 5 days is probably a good marker, probably closer to the 3-day end. And then once those kind of initial symptoms are gone, then they're saying get back to activity as much as you can, not just physical, but also cognitive activity.
And what are, just in the ballpark, the symptoms we should be looking for?
So headaches is definitely a big one. Visual symptoms. A lot of people have some visual scanning issues afterwards. Things like reading is really difficult for them. Things like looking up and down, like if they were taking notes from a lecture, is very difficult. Some nausea. And then also feeling that fogginess, that's definitely a big one that we hear.
And what did the pediatric study find specifically?
The pediatric study found that people who did get back a little bit faster did better and they had better outcomes.
Why do you think that is? Any thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. So what we know about the brain is that you have an initial injury and then you have this period of time, like within about 24 hours, where the brain kind of takes a breath. Then you get that the brain comes and says, okay, let's take care of this. So you get kind of inflammation. And that's why people don't have symptoms until about 24 hours potentially afterwards, because your brain is now taking care of that. After that, then what it needs to do is kind of clean everything out and refocus and reconnect everything. If we don't give it an opportunity to reconnect in the right way, then we have a longer recovery because we haven't given it the experience that it needs to connect the way it's supposed to.
So 3 days, 3 to 5 days just seems a lot more doable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems a lot more reasonable. It's very similar to if you get hit in the leg by a baseball. You know, for the first period of time, you're going to have trouble walking around, but then you want to get up. You want to give your lymphatic system a chance to rid itself of waste and fix itself by getting up and moving around. And although the brain doesn't have that type of a system, it has a similar way of getting rid of the things that it needs to get rid of.
In the story we just heard, Theo mentioned this fear that perhaps her brain, it won't be the same or things won't come back, function won't return. That must be a very common fear. What can you tell people who've had perhaps a more severe concussion?
Yeah, I think that what we know is most people will recover from a concussion. Many people will recover within the first 2 weeks. After that, it is slow, but hopefully steady. And most people do recover from a concussion, which is just it's a mild traumatic brain injury. As long as you're in that range, I think that there's a great likelihood that you'll recover.
Now, it seemed to me that this kind of absolute rest for 10 days wasn't around all that long. So
might this 3 to 5 days of rest not be the final answer either?
You know, that's a wonderful question. I think that this 3 to 5 days makes more sense from a neurophysiological standpoint. I think it took a while for the research to catch up to this idea that you'd stay in a dark room for so long. So I think we're more on the right track, definitely. I think it just makes more sense from what we know about the brain. So hopefully this will stay around more. I think one of the problems is that we just don't have a great way of doing research with this population. We want to do everything we can to make everyone better. So we can't have control groups and we can't study it in the right way, or at least in the way that we need to in order to get definitive answers. But I think this is a great start.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Allen is a pediatric neuropsychologist at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. The Pulse is staying home today, and our next story is about coming home from the hospital. The thing is, a lot of recently discharged patients end up not staying home for long. A study a few years ago found that about 1/5 of hospitalized Medicare patients, that's about 2.5 million seniors, are back in the hospital within 30 days. Reporter Alana Gordon recently spent a day with a nurse whose sole mission is to help solve this problem here in Philadelphia. She meets patients in the hospital, follows them home, and tries to keep them well, which sounds fairly simple, but it's not.
It's a little before 9 a.m. I spot Julie Hans in the parking lot outside Penn Carrot Home in Bala-Cynwyd.
Welcome to my second office, which is my car.
I hop in the passenger seat of her blue RAV4. It's a convenient office for Hans. She's a nurse whose entire job consists of helping seniors right when they're admitted to one of Penn's 3 hospitals safely transition home.
And our main goal is to decrease hospital readmissions.
She follows up with them for 3 to 9 months. It all means Hans spends a lot of time traveling around the region, meeting patients in the hospital, in short-term rehabs, and in their homes. The first stop of the day is a nursing facility. She's checking in with a 91-year-old woman she met a couple days ago in the hospital. The patient was in for congestive heart failure.
Oh boy, there's a female here.
Hans goes in. 45 minutes pass. Okay, so we're back in the car.
It's really eye-opening. When I first started this job, coming from working in the hospital for 11 years and not knowing what happens on discharge.
Hans learns the patient was on a regular diet and not a low-sodium one. That's really bad.
She could end up with fluid in her lungs in congestive heart failure.
Hans alerts the staff. Meanwhile, the patient didn't realize the frozen dinners she likes to eat at home have a high sodium content. Hans then discovers the patient's upcoming doctor's appointment isn't on the facility's schedule, so she could potentially miss it. Hans says her work often feels like navigating through Swiss cheese.
There's so many potentials for holes.
Holes that she's constantly trying to fill. Steve Jenks is a consultant and former Medicare official. He says the problems stem from a health system that's too complex and fragmented.
Not only does the left hand not know what the right hand is doing, but the index finger doesn't know what the thumb is doing.
Jenks led an influential study in 2009 on hospital readmissions. He found that 1/5 of seniors admitted to the hospital returned within a month from being discharged. That led to more complications down the road, and the estimated cost for unplanned visits hit nearly $20 billion in 2004.
That seems like a lot of people, and a lot of readmissions, and a lot of money, and a lot of misery.
Since the study, Medicare has started penalizing hospitals with higher-than-expected readmission rates. Places are beginning to fund new approaches, including the one that Julie Hans is part of. Jenks is all for it, but just hopes projects connect instead of adding new layers of complexity to an already complex system. It's around 12:30. Hans gets to Pennsylvania Hospital and takes a cafeteria break.
Normally I use lunch to decompress. Check email.
She then visits some patients here. Hans is one of 3 transitional care nurses. The program she's part of is the brainchild of Mary Naylor, a professor of nursing at Penn who started it 5 years ago. Naylor says, believe it or not, this represents a huge shift in healthcare culture.
Systems don't change overnight.
Naylor has spent decades trying to figure out why some patients wind up back in the hospital and what sorts of steps nurses like Hans can take to change that. She's optimistic. Overall, readmission rates are starting to go down.
We do know that people who are living with chronic illness, we can help them prevent these acute episodes of chronic illness that land them unnecessarily in the hospital. That's central to having people be able to enjoy the quality of life they deserve.
We are at the house.
Hans's final visit of the day is to Ruth Gordon's home. She's 87, petite. She cares for a son who has intellectual disability. And she's trying to manage her own congestive heart failure and other health problems.
Any chest pain or shortness of breath?
No.
Any lightheadedness or dizziness?
No.
Appetite's good?
It's getting there.
Okay. All right.
Hans says it's essential Gordon take her medicine every day, or she could wind up back in the hospital. They go through her pills.
Do you know what this is for?
No, I don't know what it's for.
It's for your blood pressure and your heart rate.
Gordon has over a dozen prescriptions. It's confusing. She admitted in a previous visit that she sometimes missed days. Hans simplified the regimen. Gordon says it's really helpful.
Your primary doctor or your doctor in the hospital, they don't tell you everything, but I want to know.
The visit lasts over an hour. It's longer than usual.
Take care.
All right, Julie, is it locked?
It is overwhelming at times. You really work to cover and close those holes as best you can, but some holes you can't, and you have to be okay with letting those go.
It's after 5 now. Hans says it was a pretty good day. She drops me off in the parking lot where we started. It's getting dark. It's time for her to go home.
Have a good night.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up on The Pulse, we'll reorganize our kitchen to get skinny.
We took a group of people and had them centralize all of their snacks in just one cupboard, not in four, but just in one cupboard, and either really high or really low on the side of the kitchen. And in this case, people ended up reporting that their snack consumption almost was cut in half.
And guess where the pantry should be? Find out as The Pulse stays home. Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to offer employees a vibrant, stimulating, and collaborative work environment. AstraZeneca aims to foster a culture that puts patients first, promotes scientific curiosity, values the power of diversity, and ultimately attracts, develops, and retains great people. Learn more about career opportunities with AstraZeneca at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is our special Staying Home edition of The Pulse. For our next story, we're going right into the kitchen. Here's the thing. If you say lose weight, I'll immediately think about diet and exercise, that candy bar I ate, gym days I skipped. But research finds you can also slim down by changing your kitchen around and reorganizing your cabinets. Joining us now to discuss this idea is Brian Wansink of Cornell University. He's written many books about behavior and eating. His latest is Slim by Design: Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life. Brian, thanks for being on The Pulse.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Philadelphia.
How are you?
yeah, cool.
Brian, tell me three things I could do today that would change my kitchen and make me healthier and slimmer.
Well, the first thing you could do is clear off all of your counters and make it as clear and orderly as possible. Because we find when we bring people into a study and we have three snacks sitting out and the rest of the place is totally cluttered, people will eat 44% more snacks than if we bring them into the exact same room with the exact three same snacks, but without the pile of mail and the open newspaper and the dishes in the drainer. So it's a really easy initial thing you can do. The second thing you can do is to commit yourself to serve any entree or starch from the stove or from the counter, plate it, and then put it on the table, or have people do that themselves. In contrast to having that huge bowl of pasta sitting right in front of you, because what we find in our studies up here at Cornell is that people end up eating about 20% less of any food that's on the counter or stove versus sitting in front of them, because they can still go back for seconds and thirds if they want to, but they're a little less likely to do that. And the third thing I'd recommend is that make sure there isn't a toaster in your counter. We did this really cool study called the Syracuse study, because we went into 230 households in Syracuse and took pictures of everything they had and weighed the family. And we found that the average family that has a toaster sitting out anywhere in the kitchen, the male of the household will weigh 8 pounds more than the daddy next door.
Why?
Well, I think it's largely because it makes bread so attractive. It's like, you know, I wasn't really thinking of bread, but toast, you know, that's a different story.
Tell me a bit about what we should do to our refrigerators. How could we reorganize them?
You know, a really, really cool way to reorganize a refrigerator is just to make sure that the fruit is front and center on the center shelf. We find that simply doing that for anybody almost doubles the amount of fruit that they eat if those apples are not in that crisper at the bottom, but they're sitting right in the front shelf. But another thing, you know, we do a lot of these kind of these cool makeovers in homes to try to make people's homes slim by design rather than fat by design. And we did one that was interesting a while back for this gossip columnist. And she said, yeah, hey, my home's not my problem, you know, because, you know, basically I've got nothing in my refrigerator, so it can't be the problem. But that actually was the problem, that if there aren't at least six single servings of some kind of protein in your refrigerator, you're tremendously prone to overeating, to ordering, you know, less great stuff in, and binging once you leave the house.
What should we do at the dining room table to make it more slim by design?
Yeah, one thing to do is to turn off your darn TV set. One of the things we find is that we did a number of cool studies, but we found that the biggest predictor of an adult's BMI, that's kind of how heavy or how fat you are, and their child's BMI was whether they ate at the dining table and whether the TV set was on. That the people were most likely to be heaviest if the TV was on or they were not eating at a dining room or kitchen table or counter. And if both those things were going on, it was almost all the time people end up being very overweight. So the first thing is sit at that table, turn the TV set off. Another thing, if people serve themselves on the typical plate, which is about 11 to 12 inches for most of us, they end up serving themselves about 22% more food than if they use a 9 to 10-inch plate. But in both cases, they rate themselves as equally full because in their mind, they ate a full plate of food. So a real easy thing to do is for the adults at the table, use a 9 to 10-inch plate.
Brian, thank you so much.
Well, it's great to talk with you.
Brian Wansink of Cornell University, he's written many books about behavior and eating. His latest is Slim by Design, Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're staying home.
In the 1950s, the DuPont Chemical Company, based in Delaware, came out with a product that had a huge impact on our home lives. Acrylic paint in every color of the rainbow.
An entirely new paint development, a new world of color. Match any elusive shade. Choose any subtle tone.
Oil paint required a crew of professionals and took forever to dry. Acrylic paints were quick dry, allowing people to redesign the look of their house in just a day. To get people into the habit of painting their walls frequently, DuPont enlisted prominent color psychologist Faber Buren. He promoted the idea that specific colors can make us feel certain ways. But as Peter Crimmins reports, color psychology is not an easy science.
It's hard to talk about color on the radio. It's a lot easier to talk about food. At 13th and Spring Garden in Philadelphia, there's an upscale pizza place called Buffade.
Buffade is slang in Italian for glutton.
That is Eve Quellman. She's a lighting designer, and she was hired to make this place feel more inviting, a place where you might want to relax and eat a hearty wood-fired pizza. She created an interior of dark grays, faded brick, rough wood planks, and she spiked this color palette by painting steel I-beams a bright red.
It's warm. There are a lot of warm colors, even though they're also cool colors, so there's a balance.
There's a textbook assumption that red is the color of attention, blue is calming, yellow is thoughtful, etc. But Quellman says none of that's really true.
I want to say people put those ideas on color, or there's historical references, cultural experience, but you can really use any color anywhere.
The hard part about assigning certain emotions to certain colors is that color never really exists on its own. It always appears with other colors around it. So it's hard, impossible really, to isolate a color as an emotional trigger. But scientists try, and they use M&Ms. I poured out a pound of M&Ms on the desk of Kevin Connolly. He's a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania studying the senses.
So we have a bunch of M&Ms here. Red and blue and orange and brown and yellow.
Green.
Oh, green, yeah.
Scientists have done studies where they give people different colored candies and ask if they taste differently. Even though the people are eating the same candy, Connolly says people imagine different colors taste different. Red might taste a little sweeter, yellow might have hints of lemon citrus, green might remind you of mint, and it will taste bad if those expectations are thwarted.
So I have this green candy here, and I taste it. And if I didn't know anything about M&Ms, I might be shocked the first time that I taste it because it's chocolatey rather than a kind of mint flavor, which is what you might expect from a green-colored candy.
Connolly says our sense of color is deeply integrated with our other senses. You never perceive only color. Your brain is constantly filtering that color through your sense of taste, of touch, of smell, and most importantly, your memories. Because the human eye is actually really, really bad at perceiving color. Your eyeball evolved mainly to see spatial relationships, like how close is that tiger to me, or how can I maneuver myself to procreate with that other person. Mohan Mathan, a philosopher of perception at the University of Toronto, says very little space in your eye is devoted to receiving wavelengths of color. Your brain has to fill in the gaps.
When color is processed by the brain, a lot of information has to be extracted from not very much incoming information. So the color that we perceive doesn't correspond at all to the colors that are in the world.
So if you see red and react with alarm, or see brown and expect chocolate, you're reacting to information already stored in your brain.
But there's no particular why of that reaction. It just happens to be wired up that way.
Because color contains very little practical information about how to navigate the world, your ability to perceive it is almost purely aesthetic. So perhaps the reason to paint your bedroom blue is not because you want it to be calming, but because you like blue. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
The world is a carousel of color.
I'm Mike and Scott, and The Pulse is staying home today, and now we're going to talk about exercising at home. By that, we don't mean that fancy treadmill that has become a $2,000 clothes rack in your bedroom. We're talking about video games. Can they really help us get in shape? Child psychiatrist Paul Ballas wanted to test this out, so he started his own company reviewing exercise games and systems. He says at first he discovered that many of these things don't really whip you into shape until he reviewed Xbox Fitness. Then his little at-home experiment became life-changing.
Xbox on.
My name is Paul Ballas. I'm a child and adult psychiatrist, and I'm also the founder of Tiro Enterprises, LLC, and I run the website movemorewithgames.com.
Xbox, go to Xbox Fitness.
This is me in 2009 in a t-shirt. You can see my face looks a lot different. My chest is much puffier, and you can tell my arms are even doughier. And that's an XXL t-shirt. This is an L I'm wearing right now. Literally, I haven't worn an L since I was 13 years old. And that was pretty much how I was year after year after year, decade after decade. That's how I looked. I've had lifelong obesity, so it's a huge, huge difference.
First section we're going to go into, we're going to wake everything up. It's called prehab or activation. We're going to put our arms at 90, feet together. Just think in your mind you're going to jump rope.
This is a very kind of new creature, which is what you would imagine you get on a DVD, but with game elements all over the place. I would never watch a DVD and do a DVD fitness workout because it's not talking back.
Ready? Let's go. Working in and out. Nice job. Quick feet. Always maintaining that knee bend, not going up and down.
I would work out. I do lifting half an hour a day and cardiovascular exercise about an hour a day and 5, 6, often 7 days a week. Workouts have always kind of been a grind to me. I always kind of saw it as a treatment for a problem I had, and I kind of saw it in a negative way, and I saw it like, man, if I wasn't so heavy, I wouldn't have to work out this hard. And that mindset was not helpful, but also made me kind of hate exercise after a while, and that's probably why I abandoned it. I'm almost 40, and I started to notice that mounting stairs was starting to become difficult. And, you know, I know in the back of my mind that this is one of the things you have to look out for. When that stuff with the stairs was happening, I was seriously thinking about getting a consultation for bariatric surgery. It was getting that bad. I was starting to very seriously worry about my health, and I really, really did not want to have a heart attack or a stroke when my kids were 10. And that was a real fear I had. So this was going to be my last shot, and it worked.
That's it. Stay with it, Jay. Stay with it. Stay with it. Stay with it. Good job. Nice.
This is called the workout celebration. And basically what it does is it ranks, takes all the game points that you got and adds them up and compares you to how you've done, how other people have done. Right there, that's how many fitness points, 13,836 fitness points. And that's 2 out of 5 stars. So you can see where I am compared to one of my friends and compared to other men. Both of us are like kicking other men's butts. But that's one of the things I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to beat my buddy next time I play this. I spent my entire adult life focusing on the right thing, which is like what my heart rate is and like my metabolic rate and how big my lift was, all these things that sounded like the right thing to focus on. But this is the sort of thing that gets people motivated. This what they call autotelic activities, activities that you do just because you like doing them. So for me, focusing on points and stars was much more effective than focusing on calories any day of the week. I have no idea how many calories I've burned this month. I know exactly how many fitness points I've achieved this month, though. People play video games all the time. At least half of adults, 80% plus kids play video games routinely every day. As a psychiatrist, I know it's easier to get the routine change as opposed to changing the entire structure or add a brand new habit. And I proved it myself. I mean, I am literally in the best shape of my adult life, probably of my entire life.
Paul Ballas reviews video games and has written a book based on his recent weight loss experience, A Doctor's Guide to Xbox Fitness. Katie Heiler produced this piece. Coming up, I don't want to freak you out, but there may be invisible dangers lurking in your home. Some that smell like nothing and some that actually kind of smell nice. We'll find out what they are. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
Taking it so
Supporting WHYY is The Pulse. AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is our special stay-at-home edition of The Pulse. We've come to associate certain smells with cleanliness, orange, pine, maybe lavender, but we might be better off getting a whiff of vinegar. Scientists at Drexel University in Philadelphia are finding that the cleaning products we use indoors can trigger a surprising amount of pollution. Jessica McDonald reports.
Think air pollution, and most people picture hazy smog outside. The kind Michael Waring envisions is harder to see and trapped under a roof.
If you're interested in things like human health and exposure, you really need to ask yourselves, where are people spending the majority of their time? And that happens to be inside buildings.
Waring is an assistant professor at Drexel and heads the school's indoor air quality lab. Inside, he shows me a large stainless steel box that is hooked up to several lines of tubing, and a pump is circulating clean air.
This is essentially a reaction vessel that we use. So the whole purpose of this is to put in stuff, watch what happens, and then measure the stuff that happens as it's coming out of the chamber.
That stuff includes two common ingredients in household cleaners, alpha-terpineol, or pine scent, and D-limonene, the smell of oranges. Both compounds are naturally occurring, and on their own, pretty harmless.
The problem happens when they're reacted with by ozone. They produce oxygenated compounds that tend to form particulate matter in the indoor air, and they also produce things such as formaldehyde.
Waring says it's not entirely clear how dangerous the newly formed substances might be, but small particles are easily inhaled, and formaldehyde is known to cause cancer. That's why he's using the big metal box to begin to characterize the basics of the reaction. One instrument, for example, determines the size of all the particles.
Particles in the air aren't just one size. There are many, many different sizes. They can be just over the size of a molecule, a little bit over that, all the way to about the thickness of a human hair.
So far, Waring has found that when limonene, the orange scent, is mixed with ozone, it produces 3 to 5 times the particulate pollution as the pine scent. It depends on the amount of air exchange and the filtration system in the home, but those pollutants can stick around for up to 10 hours. The driving force behind these indoor reactions actually comes from outside. Ozone is made when nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds from car exhausts or power plant emissions react in sunlight. But it's virtually impossible to rid a home of ozone. It comes in every time you open the door or window and seeps through cracks. Better, Waring says, is to just not use the chemicals that ozone loves to react with.
You know, I think there's been kind of a marketing campaign going on in the United States pushing this idea of clean as something you can smell.
Take this commercial for a cleaner with an aroma so strong it wakes up a sleeping hospital patient.
Woo!
That smells clean.
That's the power of Pine Sol, baby.
And I would just encourage people to question that if that's how they feel about cleanliness and they need to smell something that they spray inside their house. And instead, try to think of clean as the absence of smell and the absence of odor in the air. That's a much healthier environment.
The fact that the chemicals we use to clean our homes actually pollute the air we breathe is a bit ironic, but it's not the first counterintuitive result Waring has found during his career. As a grad student, he investigated how well so-called ion generators work to clean the air. The machines were popular about 10 years ago and sold at places like the Sharper Image, although they can still be found today. In the process of filtering out particles, the units end up producing ozone, which on its own is a potent pollutant.
And so the devices could actually operate as net particle generators rather than particle removers.
Even though ozone usually comes from outside, Waring says for the most part, outdoor air is beneficial.
If you're in a typical place in Philadelphia, you're not next to a major roadway, etc., it's always pretty good to breathe fresh outdoor air.
It's not understood why, but fresh air seems to boost worker productivity. Commercial buildings with higher ventilation rates, for instance, have fewer employees who call in sick.
Infection rates go down because any indoor emitted things by pathogens, by humans, are expelled outside more quickly.
And that might even cut down on the need to spray so much cleaner in the first place. For those not ready to give up the indoor battle with dirt, Waring suggests diluting commercial products or using a mix of water and vinegar. For The Pulse, I'm Jessica McDonald.
You're listening to The Pulse, and today we're staying home. Many people have a carbon monoxide detector in their house, but there's another gas we should pay attention to.
Radon is an invisible radioactive gas that seeps inside your home from underground.
Is radon on your radar? It can cause lung cancer. Tanya English is here to explain the common sense science and health risks.
Bob Lewis works at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. For nearly 30 years, he's been telling people to test their home for radon.
Out of sight, out of mind type thing. You know, there's no noticeable effect in the house. People just don't listen to this message as well as we'd like them to.
If there's mold in the basement, that's hard to ignore. When the roof leaks, you fix it. But a radon problem is easy to miss. The gas forms naturally in the soil, and it's all around, even in the outside air. There's only a health concern when high levels seep from the ground up into your home.
So even a crack that you might not even be able to see would look like the Grand Canyon to radon, so it's quite easy for it to get into a foundation. You basically cannot seal it out.
There's no color, no taste, no odor.
It's not going to cause any immediate symptoms.
Kevin Stewart is a health educator at the American Lung Association of the Mid-Atlantic.
Lung cancer is what's called a long latency period cancer, which means that people can be exposed to the carcinogen, the thing that causes cancer, for decades before cancer starts to manifest itself.
As radon breaks down, cast-off particles float in the air, and we inhale them.
And the biggest surface that's available in the human body for them to stick to is really the inside of your lungs. It's living cells really in contact with the outside world.
Those particles are radioactive. That means they emit low-dose energy or radiation into lung tissue.
They're the kinds of things that can barrel into a cell and break apart a strand of DNA.
Those damaged cells can multiply and then form, you know, a cancer or a tumor.
Troy Moritz is a chest surgeon at Pinnacle Health System in Harrisburg. He treats people by cutting out their cancer.
I didn't learn about radon in medical school.
But these days, public health experts are really trying to get the word out. For non-smokers, radon is the number one cause of lung cancer. And it's preventable.
If you have a very high radon level in your house, or you have a medium level over decades that you've lived there and you've never smoked, you can take a little leap of faith there that radon may have been the cause.
Every house needs to be checked, but across South Jersey, Delaware, and in the city of Philadelphia, the average potential for a risky radon level is low or moderate. The rest of Pennsylvania is different.
Click very quickly on to select your state. And a map of Pennsylvania will come up, I hope. There we go.
About two-thirds of that state map is red. It's a hot zone for radon. Health educator Kevin Stewart says there's something about Pennsylvania's geology, certain characteristics of the soil and the amount of granite rock, that can make radon levels higher. Also, lots of Pennsylvania homes have a basement.
If you have a basement, that means there's more surface area. Not only the floor, but the walls are in contact with the ground. And so there's more places for radon to enter.
Stewart says the vast majority of homeowners haven't done the test.
Open it up, and inside there is a small bag that contains the activated carbon. You can hear that, I think.
The device traps radon particles as they float by. Then a few days later, you seal up the test and send it off to the lab. A radon level of 2 to 4 is a mild danger zone. Above 4, and the government says you should call in a state-certified mitigator to make a fix. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
the Pulse, the Staying at Home edition. These days, you can be a pretty outstanding hobby astronomer without ever leaving the comfort of your home. Dragging a telescope to some faraway perfect location or rooftop, freezing while tracking meteor showers, magical perhaps, but no longer necessary. An explosion of publicly available space data and advanced technology means hobbyists can make significant contributions to the field, all without taking their eyes off their laptops.
It's mid-December, about 15 years ago, and Kevin Alton is short on gift ideas.
You know, after you're married so long, you run out of things to buy each other for Christmas. And I said, well, let's get a telescope. So that was kind of what we gave each other. And the minute I saw Saturn, which I had never seen through a telescope, I was hooked.
Alton today is still hooked. He spends a lot of his free time thinking astronomy.
My wife sits in the kitchen and does whatever it is she likes to do, and we meet up for lunch and for dinner.
In between meals, the retired pharmaceutical researcher tinkers with his backyard telescope. He's got it rigged up through Wi-Fi to a computer screen in his office. From here, if the clouds cooperate, he can track planets, comets, observe galaxies. And on one evening in 2012, Alton had an asteroid in focus. And that's when something else caught his eye.
And I said, aha, that's an interesting star that seemed to have changed over the four-hour period of time that I was observing this asteroid.
In the background, behind the asteroid, one star's brightness seemed to ebb and flow, like it was on a dimmer switch.
And I did a literature search using the internet, okay, and all of the archives and all the databases that are available, and lo and behold, no one had ever reported that that star sitting at that spot is variable.
Alton knew this wasn't a run-of-the-mill star. It was actually two stars rotating around each other, tied together by gravity, causing the light to dim and spike. He plotted his measurements using special software, submitted research to the astronomical group in charge of such things, and was eventually credited with the discovery. His very own variable star, named GSC-01208-01137. This guy, with a decent telescope and a bit of luck, advanced the field, added to human knowledge, all from his North Jersey home. And he's not alone. Even professionals are no longer tied to an observatory.
My laptop is my portal to the world. So wherever I'm physically sitting is irrelevant to the science that I'm doing.
This is Andre Persia, an astronomy professor at Villanova University. He says huge sets of images produced by mountaintop telescopes or Hubble can provide the raw materials for research. You don't need your own massive scope. All you need is a decent web connection.
That's a stereotypical picture of an astronomer gazing at the sky in the middle of the night. That's becoming less and less frequent.
What's becoming more popular are user-friendly projects that rely on armies of amateurs. Deborah Fisher at Yale University helps run the Planet Hunters website, where 300,000 volunteers log on and sift through data from NASA's Kepler spacecraft, trying to spot distant planets. Even though computer algorithms can do the same thing, humans are actually better at recognizing the telltale patterns.
In more than 100 cases, there have been unique discoveries of things that would have been completely missed, would have never been found if it hadn't been for our users around the world.
But I asked Fisher, even with this success, is there a risk of losing the mystery, the romance, of peering through an eyepiece on a clear night, seeing something so far away so clearly?
Every time I walk out of a building, the first thing I do is look up. You know, is the moon up? Is Jupiter up? Is Venus up? What cluster of stars can I see? And it's a really spectacular vision, and it always reminds me of how tiny the Earth is and how vast the universe is. And I think that's a pretty healthy perspective for people to hang on to. So I hope we don't lose that.
Even though amateurs may not all take the time-tested route to falling in love with the night sky, their new way of viewing things is already making a big impact. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Without going out of your door, you can know all things on earth. Without looking out of your window, you can know the ways of
heaven, the farther one travels.
Let's end our at-home extravaganza of the Pulse with this important announcement. You can not only look at space from the comforts of your living room, you could also fly to Mars while staying home. All right, maybe not quite, but you can participate in NASA's journey to Mars by adding your name to a silicon microchip, which will be aboard the InSight Mars lander scheduled to launch next year. Submissions will be accepted until September 8th, so hurry up. We'll link all the details on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson is our managing editor. Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and also on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's also where you can get in touch with us. Send us an email. Let us know if you have any questions, any ideas for upcoming stories. We always love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.